This is David Duke. And this is David Duke, and this is part two of the expression or reading of my preface to Jewish supremacism. Sometimes it's certainly true that the power of the spoken word far exceeds that of the written word. And by the way, when I make any quotations in this section, please refer to my book, Jewish Supremacism, or you can find the preface on my website, www.davidduke.com, and you will see all the references and citations necessary to back up the quotations that I use. So let's get going. At the end of part one, I quoted from Dr. Stephen Steinlight. He was the former director of national affairs for the most powerful and respected Jewish organization in the United States, the American Jewish Committee. And Steinlight, in a carefully worded article, admitted to his Jewish readers that, as a typical Jewish kid of his generation, he went to Jewish summer camp every year for 10 formative years, and there he saluted a foreign flag, dressed in the uniform of a foreign country, sang foreign songs, and learned that Gentiles were less sensitive, less intelligent, and less moral than Jews. That Jews were, in fact, superior. In fact, he says, quote, "I was taught the superiority of my people to the Gentiles who oppressed us." So there's a whole section, ladies and gentlemen, of Jewish supremacism and Jewish supremacist ideology that goes unreported in the press and unknown by so many people. Today, in part two, we're going to address what is Jewish supremacism and proceed on in the preface. The definition of white supremacism from the Random House unabridged Webster's Dictionary denotes it as, quote, "belief in superiority over other races and retaining of control in all relationships." Let's take the definition and apply it specifically to the term Jewish supremacism. Jewish supremacism, the belief, theory, or doctrine that the Jewish people are superior to all others and should retain control in all relationships. As to the first part of the definition, this book assembles powerful evidence that many of the leading Jews of the world have a belief, theory, or doctrine that they are superior to all other peoples. I will also clearly show that they seek control in all relationships with other peoples. David Ben-Gurion, Israel's first prime minister, often called the George Washington of Israel, said specifically that he believed in the moral and intellectual superiority of the Jewish people. That sentiment is frequent in the writings of Jewish leaders throughout the world. Imagine for a moment the outcry if the President of the United States pronounced that he believes in the moral and intellectual superiority of the white race. The Jewish-dominated world media have so shielded Jewish supremacists from criticism that their most famous leaders can say such things without any fear of repercussion. There was no outrage expressed by the world press when Ben-Gurion made his remark, nor did any protest ensue from a supremacist prophecy quoted in Look magazine in 1962, a prediction that Israel would one day sit atop a one world government. Quote, "In Jerusalem, the United Nations, a truly united nations, will build a shrine of the prophets to serve the federated union of all continents. This will be the seat of the supreme court of mankind." It also seemed cruelly ironic to his Palestinian victims that there was little outcry when the boastful terrorist Menachem Begin was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Begin brags in his book, The Revolt, about the massacre of over 200 men, women, and children at Deir Yassin. The world hunts down suspected Nazi war criminals, but gives a blood-stained Jewish one the Nobel Peace Prize. That one event should tell us who is really supreme in our modern world. The other necessary part of the definition of supremacism denotes having control over other races or other peoples. I will argue that Jewish supremacists seek to control the nations in which they dwell. They make concerted efforts to dominate the two most critical factors of power in the modern world, mass media and government. This book provides documented evidence of their incredible supremacy in these sectors. This extreme concentration of power exists not only in America, but in most of the major nations of the world, including Canada, Britain, Russia, France, Brazil, and many more. It is a universal pattern suggesting design rather than accident. Israel came into being by massive ethnic cleansing and displacement of Palestine's indigenous population. At the time of the Balfour Declaration in 1917, Jews made up only 10% of the population of what today is Israel. After the Zionist terrorists drove out the British and expelled most of the Palestinian population in 1947 and 48, Jewish supremacists established Israel. It still scrupulously preserves the cultural and genetic identity of the Jewish people. Israel protects its Jewish control over the ethnic enclave of Israel by carefully guarding its ethnic makeup. It bases its immigration on a genetic standard and limits immigration almost exclusively to those of biological Jewish descent. An atheist Jew from New York City who's never stepped foot inside Israel is financially encouraged to immigrate, while hundreds of thousands of Palestinians whose families have lived there for thousands of years cannot return to their birthplace. Israel is not a multicultural nation. It is unashamedly a Jewish state devoted exclusively to the interests, heritage, and religion of the Jewish people. A nation with a sizable Palestinian minority, it is certainly the most rigidly segregated society in the world. Separate schools exist for Jews and Arabs, separate apartment complexes, separate neighborhoods, and separate settlements. Many of the settlements were stolen from the Palestinian original occupants, such as what's happening today on the West Bank. And now they are totally segregated, Jewish-only settlements. Many policies adversely affect Palestinians as compared to Jews. For instance, Palestinians are forbidden from joining normal units of the military. In spite of their 22% of the population, which is close to double that of the African American population in the United States, there has never been a Palestinian member of the Israeli cabinet. A former member of Israel's Supreme Court, Haim Cohen, described the system that applies to Jews and Palestinians in Israel as similar to Nuremberg laws of Nazi Germany. Quote, "The bitter irony of fate, which has led the same biological and racist laws propagated by the Nazis and which inspired the infamous Nuremberg laws to serve as a basis for the definition of Judaism within the state of Israel." I go deeply into the subject of Israel in the body of this book, but I should not leave the subject now without pointing out that the Jewish supremacism that dominates Israel receives little negative press around the world. Consider the positive press that Israel receives as compared to the unanimous and universal media condemnation that was heaped upon the former apartheid regime in South Africa. Condemnation of South Africa was hypocritically led by an American media thoroughly dominated by Israeli partisans. I slowly became aware of a dual morality permeating Jewish-Gentile relations. Jews preach one morality for themselves and preach another for the non-Jewish world. Or I should say, Jewish supremacists, Jewish extremists do this. And there are certainly Jews who oppose this dual morality. The extremists' morality is one of racial pride, solidarity, tradition, and self-interests. But at the same time, they preach that for their own people. They preach diversity and liberalism for their perceived opponents or competitors. Now, if such dualism did not exist, how could the Jewish-dominated American media support the following? One, support the Nation of Israel, which promotes Judaism in its schools, while opposing even the singing of Christmas carols in American public schools. Two, support the Nation of Israel, which has strictly segregated schools, communities, and facilities for Jews and Arabs, while condemning segregated schools and housing in America and in South Africa. Three, support the Nation of Israel with its restrictive Jews-only immigration laws, while at the same time subverting American attempts to curtail even illegal immigration. Four, support the Nation of Israel, which allows every Jewish citizen to carry a machine gun if desired, while advocating gun control for American citizens. Five, support the Nation of Israel, which openly states its mission to preserve the Jewish people and Jewish heritage while condemning Palestinians who desire their own state and scourging European Americans who dare to advocate the preservation of Western heritage and culture in America and Europe. Six, always depict the historical relations between Jews and Gentiles, with the Gentiles as evildoers and the Jews as innocent victims. While condemning Gentiles as anti-Semites, if they dare to defend themselves from such ethnic slanders. Perfect examples of the gaping double standard can be found in the writings of the most important editor in recent times of our most important newspaper in America, A.M. Rosenthal of the New York Times. Rosenthal was an enthusiastic, open borders multiculturalist for America, but a rabid, close border Jewish supremacist for Israel. Such double standards in the mass media raise other questions as well. Why is the world press so myopic in regard to Israel's ethnic suppression? Is it reasonable to suspect that the bias in the press could be the result of a preponderance of Jewish power? Regarding subjects such as Jewish supremacism, this domination certainly affords a reason why the term Jewish supremacism, unlike white supremacism, is never used by the press. Nor is the concept even explored. Even when Meir Kahan called Palestinians dogs and advocated forcibly expelling all Palestinians from Israeli-occupied territory, he was never referred to as a Jewish supremacist. On February 25, 1994, an American Jew, Baruch Goldstein, entered a mosque in Hebron and machine-gunned Palestinians at prayer, killing 29 of them. Some Jewish groups in both America and Israel have since made Goldstein a saint, building shrines for him both in America and in Israel. Neither Goldstein nor those who have built shrines to him are ever referred to as Jewish supremacists or even as anti-Gentiles. On the opposite hand, if a Gentile even dares to quote the statement of I'm Cohen comparing Israeli law to Nazi Nuremberg laws, he will certainly find himself labeled as an anti-Semite by the media. The double standard of world governments and press is often quite amazing. As I write these words, the American President, George Bush, in the aftermath of the World Trade Center bombings of September 11, is busily trying to stamp out terrorism as well as wipe out, quote, all the evil in the world, unquote. He does not see that goal as even the slightest bit too ambitious. Bush announced that any action or any nation that harbors terrorists will feel the wrath of American bombs. But not long after his pronouncement, Mr. Bush dined with one of the world's worst terrorists, the Prime Minister of Israel, Ariel Sharon. As the world knows, Sharon has a long record of terrorism and murder, including responsibility for the massacre of 1,500 men, women, and children in the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in Lebanon. During dinner, President Bush did not so much as drop an olive on Mr. Sharon. Unlike hapless Afghanistan, no American bombs have fallen on Tel Aviv for harboring terrorists. In fact, Israel not only harbors terrorists, it has elevated many to be their supreme leaders. Sharon is not the first terrorist who made it to prime minister. Some of the worst terrorists who achieved that position are Begin, Shamir, and Barak. The double standards never seem to end. When an Israeli cabinet official, Rehavam Zeevi, was assassinated by Palestinians, Sharon and some U.S. officials denounced it as, quote, terrorism. But if the shooting down of Zeevi is indeed terrorism, what do we call many years of Israeli targeted assassinations of hundreds of Palestinian political figures, philosophers, clerics, even poets? Why doesn't the press point out as well that Zeevi was himself a Jewish supremacist who called Palestinians lice and has advocated their forced expulsion from the occupied territories? One might argue that the existence of a supremacist Israeli state does not necessarily mean that the diaspora, the Jews outside of Israel, has the same supremacist agenda. However, one should consider the fact that organized Jewry all over the world devotedly supports the supremacist state of Israel. Secondly, there is ample evidence that policies of Jewish supremacy extend far beyond the borders and boundaries of Israel. Powerful Jews and media and government around the world frequently act to exert control over the peoples among whom they live. Jewish groups formulate strategic agendas and act in ways that they think will serve specific Jewish interests. I think you'll be amazed by the evidence I present of the media and political power exercised by Jewish supremacists around the world. Organized Jewry can be clearly shown to have had worldwide strategic objectives since the beginning of the last century. For instance, an early 20th century goal of Russian and world Jewry was the overthrow of what they considered to be the anti-Semitic Tsarist government of Imperial Russia. Jewish communities around the world supported the establishment of a proto-Jewish communist regime in Russia. They provided most of the leadership and financing for the Russian Revolution, a revolution that was actually more Jewish-led than Russian-led. Its chief financier was, in fact, the New York Jewish capitalist and extreme Jewish supremacist, Jacob Schiff. One of the many startling documents I came across comes from the National Archives of the United States of America. It reveals that in the first government of communist Russia, there were only 13 ethnic Russians and more than 100 Jews out of a total of 384 commissars. Now, let that startling fact sink in. There were only 13 ethnic Russians in the first Bolshevik government after the Russian Revolution. The chief correspondent of the London Times in Russia at the time described it as nothing short of an alien invasion, a takeover of Russia by Jews. The same was said by our American ambassador to Russia, David Francis, and by American intelligence officers in Russia. Even Winston Churchill described the Russian Revolution as a takeover by Bolshevik Jews that had, quote, seized the Russian people by the hair of their heads and become the masters of this enormous empire, unquote. Now, this is just a small preview of the startling documents found in this book. And again, when you read this introduction, you can look and see the citations and check them out for yourselves. The successful overthrow of a major national government and a murder of its ruling family as part of a worldwide Jewish agenda shows that even in the early days of the 20th century, they had considerable worldwide economic, political, and media power. In the years since, their power has grown exponentially. Most people are still completely unaware of the paramount role of Jewry in the origins of Bolshevism in Russia and the spreading of communism throughout the world. The public's lack of knowledge in this area illustrates Jewry's influential role in academia and media. Otherwise, how could such important and easily verifiable facts of history be kept from common knowledge? It also reveals the incredible cohesion and coordination of the Jewish power around the world that can be mobilized for specific Jewish objectives. Another example of the power they wield in the highest councils of major nations was their successful effort for the establishment of Israel. From the issuance of the Balfour Declaration, only very recently did the world learn that the man who wrote the Balfour Declaration was actually a secret Jew, to the founding and continuing support for Israel, to the 2003 Iraq War, they have shown the ability to get what they want. Jewish supremacy has a hypocritical and a jealous nature. If the people among whom the Jewish supremacists reside would adopt programs of ethnic loyalty and solidarity similar to the Jewish supremacists, Jews, a small minority in most countries, could obviously not exercise power and control, for they're only a small percentage of the population. Only when the ethnic and nationalist feelings of the host people are diminished can Jewish supremacists accumulate enough power to achieve their agenda. A clear pattern of Jewish influence in academia, government, and media aims at weakening all ethnic solidarity and loyalty among their host peoples while purposefully encouraging ethnic pride and solidarity among Jews. There is a concerted effort to weaken the group solidarity of Palestinians, Britons, Frenchmen, European Americans, African Americans, and among Muslims in the Arab world. The pattern is present in all nations wherever there are significant numbers of Jews. Hypocritically, the same forces that support Jewish supremacism have accused me of being a, quote, white supremacist. I reject that epithet. For, unlike Jewish supremacists, I don't seek to rule over or control any other race. I simply want to preserve my own heritage. Recognizing that there are intrinsic differences in culture, behavior, tradition, and even genetics among the different races does not make one a supremacist. The truth be told, most people naturally prefer the association of their own racial or ethnic group, and frankly, most people think of their own group as the best. What constitutes true supremacism is when one group tries to control or be supreme over the other. The next section is Divide and Conquer, and I will cover that tomorrow in Part 3. I've enjoyed being with you today. I'm getting a lot of response from this verbal expression, this speaking of the preface to my book, Jewish Supremacism. I continue to work on it very diligently for our updated edition, which hopefully will be out in a few weeks or months. And I'm working also on my awakening and, of course, on my new book. But that is a long labor of love that still has a great bit of work to do on it. I am enjoying a fantastic backdrop here in Central Europe. The Alps are right outside my window, and it's wonderful to be in this kind of environment while I'm writing. Also, here is about the only place that I can do this kind of writing because I'm far away from an accessible telephone. I'm far away from the day-to-day demands on me that I find back in Mandeville or even at my university. So it's great to be here for a while, and I'm getting a lot done, and I do look forward to being with you again tomorrow. Thanks so much for being with me, and God bless and take care, and please do your best to spread this preface, the spoken word preface, to your friends and your family, in your neighborhood, in your city, in your state, in your country, and indeed around the world. See you tomorrow.
This has been a David Duke Worldwide Web Radio broadcast. For more information and to support our vital work, please visit www.daviddukedavidduke.com.